Multifamily Matters, a weekly radio show that discusses the current topics and trends in the multifamily industry. Stay tuned and listen to the movers and shakers in multifamily share their opinions and thoughts about what's old, what's new, and where the multifamily industry is heading in the future. You are listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.
Well, welcome and thank you for joining in to Multifamily Matters, the only broadcast radio show in the nation that is solely dedicated to the multifamily industry. I'm your host, Paul Marks, and we have a great show today with a wonderful guest who is an expert on the topic of today's show. Well, I think we all know that affordable housing is extremely important to so many people across the country. So what is affordable housing, and is there currently an affordable housing crisis in the U.S.? With this in mind, our topic today is Affordable Housing, the Thoughts and Perspectives from an Industry Pioneer. Joining me by phone is that pioneer, Daryl Carter, founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of Avanath Capital Management. Welcome, Daryl.
Hello.
You're in California, I'm assuming?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So, you know, I had the opportunity to chat with you briefly at a National Multi-Housing Council event earlier this year. I actually listened to you speak on a couple of panels and was very impressed with what you do with your company for the affordable housing industry, as well as obviously your knowledge and expertise having done it for so many years. So for the benefit of our listeners and our audience in the multifamily industry, give us a baseline definition of what affordable housing means.
Well, let's first start off and say that the median income in the United States for a renter is $38,000 a year. That's all renters. So in order for that to be affordable for the median income, that renter needs to pay about one-third of their income, or somewhere around $1,100, $1,000 to $1,100 a month.
Right.
The reality is that most renters, many renters in this country, particularly on the two coasts, pay more than 40 and sometimes 50% of their income on rent, which is not affordable. But our business, we focus on renters who make $30,000 to probably a high of $75,000 or $80,000 a year. Most of our residents, I would say, would be within the $30,000 to $50,000 of income, which would equate to, if you looked at area median incomes in across the country, we probably, the bulk of our residents are between 40 and 80% of area median income. And then when you think about our business, we own properties that have rent restrictions that are statutorily affordable by either the tax credit program or project-based Section 8 or some other affordability feature. But then we have older properties that are not rent restricted, that that are just naturally affordable housing that we renovate and try to maintain long-term affordability, because where we focus is the greatest portion of demand for rental housing in this country.
And geographically, I know you have properties on both the East Coast and the West Coast, as well as a spattering of properties throughout the middle part of the United States, including a property in Texas in the Dallas area. So when you decide to look at a property from the affordable standpoint, and you're working across the country in so many different markets, are there local or state regulations regarding affordability that you have to be aware of, or is it more of a federal type regulation?
Well, we operate in 16 states, primarily on the two coasts, and we are, each of those states have different, sometimes, they may be tax credit properties, but they're treated differently in each state. Of our portfolio of about 60 apartment communities, we probably are subject to over 70 different regulatory agreements. So, wow. Sometimes they're local. Sometimes they're statewide, sometimes they're countywide, and then some will have a national overlay, like either something with HUD or out of the Treasury, the tax credit program. So that's a big part of our business is what I call regulatory compliance, and it varies from location to location.
And I get the impression that your company is somewhat of a rare breed within the multifamily business, that it seems like in many markets around the country, the cities or the municipalities will be the ones who are providing affordable housing. And you, from a private standpoint, private company standpoint, have gone into that. Why is it that in a lot of markets, cities are so heavily involved in this?
Well, I mean, it goes to probably our history as a country, and there was this major movement in the 60s with public housing, which in some respects worked, but generally speaking did not work, and municipalities had to fill in the gap somehow. You know, you take a place like Sacramento, where we own six or seven communities. The Sacramento is, as many places, you know, there's a dire need for affordable housing. And so the Sacramento Housing Authority is one of the best that actually we work with them on a number of our properties. And I think it's in many communities, I think it's in what makes communities successful, like the city of Sacramento and another place we operate in, Long Beach, California, is that there is a commitment at the top of those cities for a variety of types of housing, which includes affordable and workforce housing. You know, it's funny because there's this somewhat of a distinction today. People say affordable housing, workforce housing, but the reality of it is, whether ours is rent restricted or not, all of our residents work. You know, I know right. There's been a lot of talk out of Washington about people who get some level of a housing assistance working. Well, the reality is that many of those entitlements were reformed during the Clinton administration. So, for instance, about 35% of our residents are Section 8. They're either project-based Section 8 or they have vouchers, which are portable. And the 95% of those residents work. And many of them are two-income families. And the reason that they qualify for Section 8 is not for anything except that they work in jobs where the pay is relatively low compared to the housing cost of where they live. So that might mean in Long Beach, California, they might make, you know, $50,000 a year, but rents are, you know, $2,000 a month. So that's the challenge in many of our across the country with affordability. It's the level of rents relative to the incomes. And so most people, you know, there are a lot of misnomers about affordable housing, and one of which there are a lot of perceptions that people who live in affordable housing or anything that's rent regulated, they don't work, and, you know, there are basically people on welfare. It is simply not the case. You know, our residents across the board, whether they have any kind of subsidy or not, they work very, very, very hard. And so, you know, when we talk about trying to distinguish an affordable and workforce, I say our affordable residents work just as hard. So I think, again, our challenge in this country is having enough affordable housing. The reality is anything that you build new today, particularly in some of the markets that we're in, like Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Sacramento, New York City, D.C., it's prohibitive. It costs, you know, $300,000 to $600,000 an apartment unit to build, which makes it very difficult to rent to people, you know, to rent at a level that's affordable to most people.
So, well, We've got about a minute left before we have to take a break. I wanted to ask you, since we've used the term in the conversation, affordable housing and workforce housing, is there any difference in that basic definition, or are they used interchangeably?
Well, we use it interchangeably, but I think most people think of affordable as being 60% of area median income and less, and workforce housing being generally between 60% of AMI and 100% of AMI. So, you know, I just happen to know that, you know, a place like, you know, Loudoun County, Virginia, that might be where the area median income is $120,000. That might be people that make $70,000 to $100,000. That may be in the workforce category. But, you know, I don't think there are any hard definitions, but that's how generally people think about it.
Okay. All right, great. Well, we're going to be back with much more about affordable housing and more discussions with Daryl about his expertise and what he's doing around the country. We're going to be back after this short break. You are listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.
Your property and liability insurance is one of your highest expenses. Put Ted W. Allen and Associates' 50-plus years of experience in multifamily insurance to work for you. If you have multiple properties on separate policies, you may qualify for a master policy, which can eliminate the need for multiple insurance renewals and provide you significantly lower premiums. Call Ted W. Allen and Associates at 281-378-7500. That's 281-378-7500. Or online at tedwallen.com.
Looking for cost savings and curb appeal? Call WaterLogic, the nation's specialist in multifamily property water management. Using interactive, smart water technology, WaterLogic's professionals can help you save up to 40% on irrigation water annually, potentially adding tens of thousands of dollars back into your budget. Call WaterLogic at 713-983-9555 for a no-cost irrigation usage analysis. Your property will look great, and you'll be a hometown hero.
Well, we're back, and you're listening to Multifamily Matters, and we're discussing affordable housing, the thoughts and perspectives from an industry pioneer. And I'm Paul Marks. Joining me by phone from California is Daryl Carter, founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of Levanith Capital Management, and a company that specializes in affordable and workforce housing around the country from coast to coast. Daryl, I know a little bit about your background and your biography. I know that you studied architecture, and besides going to the University of Michigan, you're an MIT fella. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into not only the multifamily industry, but specifically affordable.
Well, I'm originally from Detroit, and my real passion as a kid was really, you know, I could never pass a construction site without watching it. And there was a lot of building, you know, growing up in Detroit in the 60s. There was, you know, that was at the high time of Detroit, and then we kind of had the Detroit riots in 67, and then it started a long decline. And, you know, Detroit was a city of immigrants, and everyone, you know, that gravitated there from the auto industry, and my parents, who grew up in the South, African-American, they left the South for better opportunities in the auto industry in Detroit, and we lived in a very working-class neighborhood where very small homes. We lived in a house that was probably 900 square feet. You know, they were built for workers, so it was affordable. And so I've always had that passion as I, you know, when I got out and I started my career in banking in Chicago and in specifically in real estate. And I always felt that, you know, there as I, you know, grew in the business and saw lots of opportunities and was involved with financing large projects, places like my own neighborhood in Detroit started to decline and across the country. And there was just not the capital flows into those places. So Avanath is actually the second company that I built in the apartment space. My first company, which was called Capri Capital, which my former partner still operates, it was involved in investing in markets that were historically underserved by institutional capital. And when starting Avanath, I really wanted to focus on creating a better approach for affordable and workforce housing. And generally speaking, what I wanted to do is take some of the best practices in the A space and apply them to the bottom rung of the apartment industry, where I felt there was a greater market. So we've been very instrumental in involving technology on our management side, just the way other people do it in the A space, and a high level of customer service, which is often, you know, unfortunately, customer service is not something that is practiced a lot at the lower end of the apartment market. And I think that, you know, you can read examples. Probably the worst is the book by Matthew Desmond, which Evicted, which chronicles practices of certain landlords in this neighborhood in Milwaukee. And that's the worst of the industry, and certainly the likes of Donald Sterling and discriminatory practices. And we felt that we could, you know, with having, we would target, for instance, diverse neighborhoods, many communities of color that had not been focused on with institutional capital, and, you know, really providing a higher level of service for our residents. And that was just our strategy. And in many respects, you know, in all my readings of different business models, there were two that stood out to me. One was Sam Walton and trying to bring the best service and lowest prices to the, you know, to the biggest part of the market, which the market we focus on is where most renters are. The second is you look at a company like Marriott. Marriott owns the Ritz-Carlton, but they also own Fairfield Inns. And Fairfield Inns, it's much cheaper, but they provide superior customer service. You're greeted in a professional way and very clean accommodations. And so that's what we view ourselves as, the Fairfield Inns of the apartment industry, and providing a great value and good customer service to our residents who are at the lower and moderate incomes.
You know, I happened to be at a affordable property late last week in the Houston area. And when I was in the office, I noticed that the residents, the children of the residents, were coming in. They were talking with the managers, and the managers were taking care of their needs. I'm assuming that there is a big kind of neighborhood feeling in many affordable housing because there's so many families that are there. Is that your experience?
Well, we have found in our family communities, and we really try to focus on family communities. In our basic business model, we acquire and we renovate more so than we develop. And we like to buy properties with larger unit counts, particularly three bedrooms and even four bedrooms, because we think that families are the biggest segment of the market. And two things about that. One is that because parents work, a big challenge that we have is, you know, the school bus pulls up at 3 o'clock and then kids descend on a property. I mean, we have properties. We have one in Long Beach where it's 528 units, and we estimate that we have 1,200 kids. Mm. So what happens after school makes a big difference in that community. And so we try to create activities at our properties where we have large concentrations of children so that they're in a safe environment after school until their parents get home for work. That's one interesting phenomenon. The other that you mentioned, we have learned that in many communities, particularly where English is not the first language, that a lot of the interaction we have are with children because the children speak better English. And one of the things that we then, we created, and my head of property management encouraged me, who basically said, you know, I think our residents are more reliant and they use technology in a broader sense. And so we created an app that our residents use, and you know, particularly the kids who all have smart phones, they get it and they understand how to do maintenance requests. They can pay rent, you know, or anything on their phones. And we get a very high adoption rate of that. But it is interesting you mentioned that. It's the same thing that we find that children very often, because they may be, you know, the parents are working longer hours, they come in and they interact with our staff at our communities.
And do you try and have parts of the communities dedicated for where the kids can go at all to congregate or to work on homework? Or I know some affordable property has had that.
One of the things we have, you know, these clubhouses at all of our apartment communities that I always found, you know, they get used Super Bowl Sunday. And I have a sister who is in education, and she told me, she said, wow, you know, there are a lot of nonprofits out there that do after school programs. Their biggest challenge, they don't have space. And so one of the things that we have in a lot of our communities, we bring a nonprofit partner in, a nonprofit in, and we provide support for them and the space in our clubhouses, and they operate after school programs. And it's something that's a real win-win, because it's enrichment for the kids, it's a safe environment, and it gives the parents a great degree of comfort. And I would say that, you know, part of that is a big reason when you look, for instance, our turnover statistics run about 15% so we retain about 85% of our residents on renewal. Typically someone is doing really well if they have a 50% renewal rate in the apartment industry. And so ours are low because people want to be there. And, you know, when I'm in our rental offices, the biggest traffic are our residents coming in wanting to get a friend in, and of our communities, more than half of them have waiting lists. And it's really, you know, sometimes it really kind of breaks my heart. We own a property in downtown Los Angeles that is really close to the train station, and it's 101 apartments. And we had one unit vacate last year, and we have 300 on the waiting list.
Oh, my gosh.
And you will find that, I mean, when I was in Orlando the other week, where we own about 1,000 units, and we had three vacant apartments and waiting lists on all of our communities that was, you know, several hundred. So that's a real, you know, while we love that we have this demand, I wish that we could accommodate more residents at our communities, but, you know, that's our challenge. That's a national challenge.
Yes.
Not enough quality, affordable rentals.
I guess that's the crisis that I read about. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to be back. I just want to remind our listeners that you can go to our website at www.multifamilyradio.com and listen to any archived episode or make suggestions for show topics and guests. We'll be back after the short break. You are listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.
Looking for cost savings and curb appeal? Call WaterLogic, the nation's specialist in multifamily property water management. Using interactive, smart water technology, WaterLogic's professionals can help you save up to 40% on irrigation water annually, potentially adding tens of thousands of dollars back into your budget. Call WaterLogic at 713-983-9555 for a no-cost irrigation usage analysis. Your property will look great, and you'll be a hometown hero.
Your property and liability insurance is one of your highest expenses. Put Ted W. Allen and Associates' 50-plus years of experience in multifamily insurance to work for you. If you have multiple properties on separate policies, you may qualify for a master policy, which can eliminate the need for multiple insurance renewals and provide you significantly lower premiums. Call Ted W. Allen & Associates at 281-378-7500. That's 281-378-7500. Or online at tedwallen.com.
Well, we're back, and you're listening to Multifamily Matters, and today we're discussing affordable housing, the thoughts and perspectives from an industry pioneer. I'm Paul Marks, and I have that industry pioneer on the phone with me from California, Daryl Carter, founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of Avanath Capital Management. Before we get back into the discussion, I just want to remind our listeners that you can go to our website at www.multifamilyradio.com, and also thank our exclusive sponsors that make Multifamily Matters possible. E-Conserve, providing multifamily water conservation solutions for properties across the U.S. WaterLogic, the smarter way to water, providing professional irrigation water management. And Ted W. Allen & Associates, specializing in multifamily habitational insurance since 1967. Daryl, we were talking during the break about some of the myths that are abound about the affordable housing out there in the multifamily industry. Tell us some of those myths and what's true and what's not true.
Well, it's a key part of our educational process, particularly for institutional investors. When I started this company 11 years ago, and the hardest thing was certainly was the timing as well, 2008, was raising institutional capital, and the perceptions were both in terms of some of the neighborhoods we were looking to invest in and the market segment, which were lower and moderate income people, that there'd be greater management challenges and, the people would destroy the property. And many of the myths that exist in affordable housing really date back to, I think, some of the notorious housing, public housing projects like Cabrini Green in Chicago or Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis. But myth one is that, the residents are difficult and it's hard to get people to pay rent. The statistic, if you look at the apartment industry, delinquencies range from 60 basis points to 1% somewhere in there, probably 0.75%. Three quarters of a percent is where most people underwrite apartment delinquencies. Mm-hmm. Ours run about 35 basis points. So we're half of what the industry standard is. So that's one myth, that the fact that there are significant collection issues. The second thing is, there's a perception of safety and, there's lots of crime. Well, our communities are reflective of what happens in a neighborhood, but I can tell you there are a lot of ways that when we buy communities, we make them safer. And above all things is, being respectful of our residents, listening to what things they'd like to see in the community, maintaining everything. We get a lot of support from our residents in making our communities safer. And one of the things that helps make a community safer, when you think about it, if we're only having 15% turnover a year, our residents know their neighbors. And I think knowing your neighbors is the most important thing. And one of the things that happens in the apartment industry, and I have good friends who are developers and who do different things, and where they will do buy older apartment communities with the goal of, maybe doubling the rents and doing a class A kind of renovation. And they're saying, look, we're looking to turn the community over, 60 to 75% of new residents. That level of turnover, I ask people sometimes when I hear it, You know, if you live in Scarsdale, New York, or Newport Beach, California, and you live in this nice community, how would you like it if your neighbors turned, if you had 75% new neighbors every year? And sometimes we have to think about some of our strategies. And one of the things that we found when we buy older C properties, we try to really do smart renovations where we look at everything that we do and say, does this benefit the resident? Is it a safety issue? Certainly, we mitigate all safety and structural issues and any kind of things like that. Building systems, air conditioning, heating, plumbing, all that, make that sound. And then we look at certain things, like we don't necessarily replace the cabinets. We've learned to resurface the cabinets. If you replace the cabinets, it might be an additional $30 or $40 in rent. If we resurface the cabinets and put on new hardware, maybe that's $5 in rent. So we value engineer every renovation against maintaining a level of affordability. So very often when we buy something that we can that is unregulated, you know, we might raise the rents 15%, but we provide a much better product, and B, we'll add enhancements like washers and dryers or something that, of course, is a value add, because if someone has to go to a laundry room or a laundromat, they're going to spend $50 to $60 a month in tokens and things like that, and they don't have it in their unit. So, you know, in certain things, and one of my people, I always use it in my speeches because we have a couple of investors that will walk into one of our renovations, and they'll look at the popcorn ceiling, and they'll say, wow, you know, it'd be really the 60s, 70s version popcorn ceiling. It would be great if you could remove that. And I always say, look, that's probably $60 to $70 of rent. If you were to ask the residents, you know, would they rather pay $60 or $70, the answer was no. And I said, at the end of the day, everybody now can afford a $300 big screen from Costco. They're looking at their TV, not the ceiling.
Exactly.
So those are the kinds of things that we do to try to maintain affordability. But getting back to your original point, myths are a major challenge that we have, and very often, it's funny. People will when we actually get them to see one of our communities, they're always shocked. They'll say, "Wow, this is much nicer than we envisioned." So one of the great things about our business, people generally have such low expectations of what affordable communities look like when they come on site to our properties, they are like, wow, this is really nicer than I thought. So it's always great that when people have very, very low expectations.
Well, and you know, when you were talking about creating a community where everybody knows their neighbors and so forth, I just was wondering, when you were saying that, is it difficult to find the folks that you need to manage the property and to work on the property? Does it have a stick? Does affordable have a stigma as far as trying to find good people to work, number one? And number two, what type of training do you give to your management teams in order to be able to create that environment of a neighborhood on the property?
Well, it's a great question. And number one, I would say that what we're blessed to have at Avanath is a team of people, both at our headquarters and our properties, that buy into our mission that we're doing something unique and special, and that is we're providing quality homes that are incubating the dreams of all of our residents. And that's our mission. We do a lot of training of our on-site people. We let them know, look, these are our residents' homes. This is where they live. We're just the caretakers. We're just supporting their dreams and vision. It's not that we own it. It's their community. And so we do a lot of that. And part of it is, you know, we get a lot of buy-in, for the mission, that we're doing. And it's a unique mission to bring quality to this segment and to many of the communities. And I would say that if you look at our team at headquarters and on site, we're very, very diverse. And we have people who grew up in communities like this, who have a cultural affinity for it. And so that helps a lot because very often in the industry, the industry does not look as diverse as our company. And that's one of the things that people will very often, if they're not comfortable getting out of a car in North Long Beach or West Oakland, they're probably not going to invest there. And so having a team of people who grew up in East LA or grew up on the west side of Detroit or any of these other communities, I think gives us a leg up on investing in those communities.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. We are going to take a break in just a second, but I did want to ask you and just touch on it now, because I'm sure you can't answer it in the amount of time we have left, but when you choose a property, or I'll pose the question and you can answer it in the next segment, when you choose properties and locations to invest in, I know that you're heavily concentrated on the West Coast and on the East Coast, but when I look at your portfolio map, I notice you have one property in Texas and you got one property in Colorado. So I want to find out a little bit about how you strategize on where you're looking to invest. But we do need to take a quick break. We can answer that in the final segment. We will be back with our final segment after this short break. You are listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.
Looking for cost savings and curb appeal? Call WaterLogic, the nation's specialist in multifamily property water management. Using interactive, smart water technology, WaterLogic's professionals can help you save up to 40% on irrigation water annually, potentially adding tens of thousands of dollars back into your budget. Call WaterLogic at 713-983-9555 for a no-cost irrigation usage analysis. Your property will look great, and you'll be a hometown hero.
Your property and liability insurance is one of your highest expenses. Put Ted W. Allen and Associates' 50-plus years of experience in multifamily insurance to work for you. If you have multiple properties on separate policies, you may qualify for a master policy, which can eliminate the need for multiple insurance renewals and provide you significantly lower premiums. Call Ted W. Allen & Associates at 281-378-7500. That's 281-378-7500. Or online at tedwallen.com.
Well, we're back with our final segment of Multifamily Matters, and we're discussing affordable housing, the thoughts and perspectives of an industry pioneer. I'm Paul Marks, and my guest is Daryl Carter, founder and chairman and chief executive officer of Avanath Capital Management. He's calling in from California. Before we get back into the conversation, I do want to remind our listeners that you can always listen to us right here on 1110 AM, KTEK, every Friday at 10 a.m., or you can go to the KTEK website and listen to it from any device that you have. You can also listen to it on your iHeartRadio app, and you can go to our Multifamily Matters website at www.multifamilyradio.com. Listen to this episode as well as any other episode. Daryl, I posed a question to you before the break that I wanted you to answer. Restate the question for our listeners in your own words, because it's probably better than mine, and then also tell us what your thoughts are on it.
Well, the question was, how do we look at locations and when we make acquisition decisions? And I would say that we always study a market in detail before we go into it. And perfect example, most recently, we entered Seattle, and we thought Seattle had very similar attributes of other communities that we knew very well, particularly the Bay Area, very similar economy, demographics, and the like. So we started probably three and a half years ago. We bought our first property in Seattle. and we bought two more since then. And it's our goal generally to get up to 1,000 to 1,500 units in a market so we can start realizing some economies of scale. The last market that we entered was Denver, and we felt it too had similar attributes. And also, you know, it was a location that was relatively close by flight to California, our headquarters. So we started about a year ago with our first property there, and we continue to look to adding to that. We certainly took on that strategy in Dallas. We only have one, but we've looked. It's a very competitive market, but we hope to add there. Recently, we have bought three deals this year. We're on our about to close our third one in Chicago, where we had had one for some time, and we had looked, and now we're getting some scale there. But in general, you know, we like markets where there are high job growth and job stability, and where there's a variety of different types of jobs. There's a great airport. What's fascinating about our portfolio, we're located in 10, in about half of the markets that are Amazon finalists. I think the same criteria that they use in looking at markets is clearly seems to have some overlap with what we do. And in particular, you know, when you look at a place, we have three or four properties, one in outside Detroit, my hometown, and that's another place that we continue to look for new opportunities. But we own a property there that is it's right adjacent to the University of Michigan and Eastern Michigan University, and college towns have a lot of people that work there, particularly at the lower end of the pay scale. And we own, there are two or three other communities that we own, the community in Boulder, Colorado. It's right across the street from the University of Colorado. And the same, we have a property in Poughkeepsie, New York, that is very close to Marist College and Vassar. So colleges have a lot of demand for workforce housing. So that's been one of the themes that we've looked at from a location standpoint. The other thing I would say that we also have a theme, when you look at multifamily, the multifamily industry in terms of inventory, and if you look at what is affordable, which is generally older, there's a lot of that product that are in buildings that are smaller than 100 units and even smaller than 50 units. So we've had an investment strategy to acquire smaller buildings in a concentrated location. So we own 400 apartments in Brooklyn, in Park Slope and Bed-Stuy and Williamsburg that are, you know, our largest building that's 50 units. Mm-hmm. So we have we have like 20 buildings there, and some of them as small as 8 units. But we're able to get the management scale because they're close together, and we have different mobile protocols for managing. And so one of the things we've tried to do is where we have larger properties to buy smaller properties around it because there are many, many smaller properties that are owned by, you know, small owners. That are generally very well maintained, but when there is the patriarch or matriarch of the family passes away, then no one's there to step up. So we have found some really wonderful gems across the country of properties that are 50 units or smaller, either that we buy in close proximity or in close proximity to some of our larger properties.
And I guess, as you said, you have to hit that critical mass as far as being able to have enough surrounding it to be able to make it make sense to buy those smaller properties.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you a question. Is the affordable housing sector, is it profitable for the owners and investors? compared to market rate?
Well, we believe it's very profitable. It has different characteristics in terms of return. You know, if we're targeting low teen returns, which is probably what value-add apartments are targeting, the difference is that, you know, we have a very high component of current cash flow. So if we're targeting 14, we're going to be 7% cash flow and 7% appreciation, where versus a value-add apartment fund may be, you know, 75% may be on the appreciation of value. So we believe that, you know, that the return criteria for our business is, it's a very low beta business, meaning that we have very little volatility in our cash flow, and we maintain very, you know, strong occupancies. And you know, to a certain extent, we're defensive in the sense of a downturn. We still serve a lot of people in our segment. One of the things, if you look at institutional capital flows, most institutions, they flow in the segment of apartments that rent levels are $2,000 a month to $5,000 a month. And certainly, there is a perception that the higher quality buildings, that's the way to go. But in reality, the risk in that segment to me is that if you can afford rent of $4,000 a month, you can also afford to buy a house.
Right.
So in many of our communities, you know, that we own, the differential between our rent level and the mainstream market level might be, our rents may be 30 to 40% lower. And so that's why we have demand, because we are at the price points, you know. I mean, the reality of it is more people can shop at Walmart than Neiman Marcus. That's the way our business is the Walmart of the apartment business.
That's exactly right. And you mentioned rents of $4,000 a month. And in Houston, we have, you know, A-class properties that have rents that are right up there. And I just wonder how they find people to fill them up with the fact that they can go out and own a home. And of course, we've had a situation in Houston, I think, with the Hurricane Harvey that we had, where a lot of people were displaced from their homes. And I think they enjoyed the resort-style living in the apartments and have decided to stay there instead of going back into their homes. But I wanted to ask you, since we are headquartered in Houston, have you investigated the Houston market at all as far as for affordable? I know that a common theme I hear is there's not a lot available at a price as far as assets at a price that is affordable. It's very competitive here.
It is very competitive there. We like Dallas. We certainly like Houston, and we've looked in Houston. We've looked in Austin. We just have not, you know, there's a lot of great people in Texas who do a great job of getting the little gems that we can find in other places. So I think our situation in Texas is less, we have one property there, not because of our lack of interest, but the strong interest that many have, particularly who are domiciled there.
Right.
And, you know, Texas is a wonderful state, and it's one that we would like to have more inventory in, particularly Dallas and Austin and Houston. But again, the people in that state are very, very good. And I look at a lot of my friends in the business, you know, Sue Ansel, Ken Valick. These are people, you know, Trammell Crow and Gables. They do an awful good job in their hometown. So, you know, I think that Texas is a great state and with great opportunities. It's been harder for us to break in.
And I understand that. I do want to let our listeners know that you served as the chairman of the National Multifamily Housing Council recently, and a few years ago. Tell us a little bit about that organization and why it's so beneficial to the industry.
Well, NMHC is just it does a great job of representing the interests of apartment owners and, more importantly, our residents, and having a political voice. And you know, historically, homeowners tend to be given a greater voice in public policy than renters, and that's what I think NMHC does. And it provides us a great forum to meet with policyholders. There was a group of us that met with Secretary Ben Carson about 6 weeks ago, and basically to give him kind of a view of what's happening on the ground. And he was very, very receptive to both our ideas, but wanting to hear what was going on. But I think NMHC is a tremendous organization for, again, providing a voice mainly for our residents, who are often not given the same political voice as homeowners. And certainly, you know, we have found that many policyholders, many of the people who are in office in the Senate and the administration and Congress, you know, they sometimes, you know, don't understand the rental industry as a whole as much as the contribution that renters make, as well as what brings it, the rental industry brings into the economy. So I think NMHC and the staff and does a great job in being the voice of both the industry and our residents.
That's great. And with that, we have to wrap up this episode of Multifamily Matters. Daryl, it has been a real pleasure to have you on the show, and look forward to having you on again. And I know you have some fine folks in your company that are very active in NAA and other organizations. We'd love to have them on as well. So thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure, and I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
We will be back next Friday at 10 a.m. with another great topic and another great panel of guests. You're listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.
Thank you for listening to Multifamily Matters, a weekly radio show that discusses current topics and trends in the multifamily industry. To find out more about the show or make suggestions for topics or interesting guests, go to multifamilyradio.com. You have been listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.